it's Diane. On my mind, remembering the Alamo. The battle of the Alamo looms large in the story of how Texas first became a nation, then a state. You've probably heard it before. Davy Crockett and a band of rebels fought troops from Mexico and set the stage for Texas independence. But in the last decades, historians began to question this narrative, arguing this version of history is largely myth and leaves out the critical role issues like slavery played in the state's path toward independence. A new book tries to set the record straight. It's called Forget the Alamo, The Rise and Fall of an American Myth. Authors Brian Burrow and Chris Tomlinson join me to explain why, now more than ever, we need to get the history right. Chris, I'll start with you. I gather you're a fifth-generation Texan. What were you taught about the Alamo?
Well, I was taught that one of my ancestors died in the Alamo, which turned out to be a complete lie. But, you know, so it all kind of starts there.
What does that mean? You understood that one of your ancestors died. Tell me that story.
My grandfather told me that there was someone named Tomlinson who died at the Alamo. And at the state capitol, on the monument to the defenders of the Alamo, it's spelled Tomlinson, T-O-M-L-I-N-S-O-N. And that's what I believed. But then you go to the Alamo and it's spelled Tomlinson, T-U-M-L-I-N-S-O-N. And it turns out my grandfather completely made it up based on the monument in Austin, and that my family didn't come to Texas till 15 years after the Revolution.
And
that?
This is not an unknown thing, I should point out, Diane. Sometimes I've heard it called Alamo Syndrome, the most fatal victim of it being our former president, Lyndon Baines Johnson, who famously claimed to have an ancestor at the Alamo, who also just happened not to be at the Alamo.
So, Brian, what does remember the Alamo mean to you?
Well, to me, it's always been almost like a secret greeting for Texans, especially those of us who were expatriates for many years. I've returned to the state after 30 years up in New York. It was given birth as a rallying cry at the Battle of San Jacinto in 1836. But ever since, it has been, sometimes a greeting, sometimes a put down if administered to people of color. It has been a code word really for the idea of Texas exceptionalism, the idea that Texas is somehow, in an idea prized by generations of Texans, somehow a cut above the Delawares and Rhode Islands in the world, in large part because of our history, because we are the only state to defeat an independent nation in an independent war and gain our independence. And that's really the basis of Texas exceptionalism.
And yet, it says, though, slavery, Chris, is at the heart of this whole issue of the Alamo. Can you talk about that?
Sure. And this isn't a new idea to us. I mean, Andrew Torgett wrote a great book, Seeds of Empire, where he explains the economics of it, the reason why Stephen F. Austin and American colonists moved to Mexico was to grow cotton. The land was going bad in Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia. They had overfarmed it. It wasn't producing well. People had lost a lot of money in the commodities markets of huge swings in cotton prices. So Texas was this place with good cotton land where they could bring slaves, start over, and hopefully, you know, make a fortune. The Mexican Revolution overthrew Spanish rule, and from the very beginning, the new Mexican government intended to ban slavery, and they did that in many different ways, in many different iterations, and Stephen F. Austin, from the very beginning, was fighting to preserve slavery through federalism, that somehow Tejas would have its own constitution that would allow slavery for so many years or allow indentured servitude and make it different from the rest of Mexico. And so this tension existed from the very beginning.
So the title of your book, Chris, Forget the Alamo, the Rise and Fall of American Myth, is what most of us have thought for all these years, total myth about the Alamo. What is truth and what is fact?
Well, we know that Jim Bowie, Davy Crockett, and William Travis were there. That's about all we can be absolutely certain of. The story of how they, you know, were slowing down the Mexican army, that explanation was invented after the battle by Sam Houston. The battle did not really slow Santa Anna down significantly. He was still waiting on troops to catch up to him when the battle was over. You know, they fought valiantly to the death. Well, we know a third to a half ran away and tried to escape the insurmountable odds of the Mexican army, and they were chased down by Mexican cavalry. And that's, you know, just kind of the beginning to scrape the surface of so many stories, like the line in the sand, completely invented from whole cloth 36 years after the battle to give a biblical dimension to the Alamo. And so many people take all of these things as truth.
It's so interesting, Brian, that this book is coming out in the middle of major pushbacks in places like Texas against attempts like this one to debunk historical myths.
We have been very lucky in terms of our timing, obviously. Yes, we were probably aware when we started this that America was undergoing, you know, a fairly sweeping reassessment of its racial history centered on Confederate statuary, really. When Chris came to Jason and I with the idea, however, it was not, the idea wasn't to make a political argument or to write a political book. To me, it was about the historical curiosity of how all these many myths of Texas history surrounding the Alamo, both those about the larger revolution and about the battle and siege itself, had stood up for so long when they're demonstrably false. And so that's how the book became a historiography, looking at not just the history, but the history of the myth, how we went from this fairly inconsequential little battle that killed barely 200 people in 1836 to within 50 and 100 years. It becomes this consuming legend and myth of at the center of Texas identity. And that was really, I think, the appeal for, certainly for me. And the amazing thing is that it continues to this day, that in fact, fighting about this, arguing about this, which really only began back in the 1970s and 80s, has only steadily ramped up and has, depending on your political viewpoint, you know, it has gotten wrapped up in the political polarization of current events.
And now you've got Governor Greg Abbott of Texas signing a bill creating the 1836 project designed to promote patriotic education. What in the world does that mean to you, Chris?
Well, it's the Ministry of Information Propaganda. I mean, that's what this is going to become. So many of these myths are designed and were written to reinforce white supremacy, to justify Americans stealing almost half of a foreign nation's territory from them, to justify ethnic cleansing of Tejanos, people of Mexican descent in Texas, to justify slavery. All, you know, these myths were invented to support those things. And now that those myths are under attack, now that those ideas of white supremacy are under attack, The governor feels the need to create a commission to reinforce these old perspectives for fear of losing them. So it's weak sauce. He has a commission. They're going to draft up pamphlets. They're going to have recommendations. I'm sure we won't stop here since Governor Abbott seems to be set on running for president in 2024. He's going to attract as much attention to himself as possible. It's a propaganda operation.
Go ahead, Brian.
The really sad thing here is that this is, as we point out, perpetuating, going on 200 years of this Anglo-centric myth at a time that Latinos who have suffered in the face of this narrative, as we quote many of them in the book, talking about how this myth is often used to oppress them, how they felt they were American until seventh grade Texas history, when they were told, "You guys killed Davy Crockett," that type of thing. At a moment that Latinos are poised to become a majority of the Texas population, where Anglos are only 41%, our Anglo government is doing this, and it just boggles the mind.
So take us back to 1800. What did Texas look like in that day?
Texas in the early 1800s was a lightly populated northernmost Mexican province after one of a number of aborted amateur American invasions in the 18-teens, a bunch of slaveholding Southerners trying to grab it. It was defeated. The Mexican forces rode in 1813, I think it was, and pretty much killed everybody they could grab, so that by the end of this, circa 1820, there are a grand total of about 4,000 people living in Texas. There are Manhattan office buildings where there's more people living than there were in Texas at the time. In three towns, the largest of which was San Antonio, maybe 2,500 people there. And the real problem that brought on American settlement was a blitzkrieg of Comanche attacks. The Comanches, who lived north and west of Texas, raided Texas throughout the 1810s, stealing every horse and mule they could find to sell to the American states in Louisiana and the colony in Arkansas. At which point, the Mexican government was like, it would really be great if there were some people living in Texas who could get in the way of all these Native Americans. And so when a down-and-out American would-be impresario named Moses Austin showed up in San Antonio and said, "Hey, how would you feel if I brought a couple of hundred American families in to start settlement and raising cotton? Would you let us do that?" Mexico was like, "Come on in." And that's when the trouble really began.
Well, so did the U.S. want that part of Texas?
Oh, my goodness. They wanted all of Texas.
They wanted all of it.
Well, let's be clear. I mean, if you go back to James Monroe and James Madison, they covertly sponsored an invasion of Mexico in the 18-teens. Throughout the 1820s, as Mexico grabbed its independence from Spain in 1821, two different American ambassadors were sent to Mexico City with big checkbooks intended to buy Mexico, and Mexico City said thanks, but no thanks. At which point, one of the particularly numbskull ambassadors began writing letters to the new American settlers, saying, "You guys really ought to think seriously about a revolution. I'm sure America would look kindly on that." So the American government, up to and including Andrew Jackson, desperately wanted Texas. It was all there for the taking. Somebody just had to give it to them.
So, Brian, you're there in Austin now. Tell us about Stephen Austin, the so-called father of Texas.
He was the father of Texas. He deserves the title as much as anyone. He was the son of Moses Austin, the first impresario, and he took over running the colonies when his father passed. Stephen F. Austin was a fascinating character. He was that rare thing, a frontier intellectual, a kind of dark and brooding type of fella who was spectacularly successful at drawing in American settlers, establishing cotton plantations, and opening up new markets, first in New Orleans, New York, and ultimately within 10 years, Texas cotton planters are selling their products as far afield as Liverpool in England. He had mixed success, however, reinforcing the foundation of this new Texas economy, which was slavery. The Mexican government, which from the beginning was stridently abolitionist. You know, every time Austin turned around, he was getting a letter or a messenger from Mexico City saying, you guys got to get rid of slavery. You got to. And if you go and you look at his letters, if you look at his correspondence, his diaries, he is down in Mexico City a couple of different times, which is a long trip, doing everything he can to lobby in favor of slavery. And it's an up and down struggle throughout the 1820s. And every time the Mexican government announces slavery is over, people stop coming to Texas because they won't try to farm cotton without slavery. And many of those who were there start saying, well, that's it, we're leaving. Well, eventually this went on so long that they put away their suitcases and took up their guns.
What about the Tejanos? And to what extent did their interests align with the Anglos when it came to demands from Mexico, Chris?
Well, the Tejanos obviously are of Spanish and Mexican and indigenous descent. They primarily lived in San Antonio southward. They didn't live up in the swamps around Houston where the best cotton land was. And they saw an opportunity to expand their mercantile businesses. They saw an opportunity to sell more beef to these new American settlers because they were ranchers. They raised horses. So they stood to profit from basically being the suppliers to these American plantation owners and these American farmers who were coming to Texas. They also were interested in that relief from the Comanche raids because the Mexican government was not sending any troops. And if they did, they didn't come with weapons or shoes or horses. So they were basically just a tax on the local people. So initially, you know, that was a business opportunity, an economic opportunity. When Santa Anna did away with federalism, suspended the Constitution, they were the ones actually calling for a revolution with the leaders of other provinces of Mexico. They wanted to overthrow Santa Anna and they wanted to restore the Constitution of 1824. The Americans, when they joined in, they had a different agenda. And because by that point, the white Americans outnumbered the Tejanos, they kind of co-opted the revolution and it became about winning independence and eventually joining the United States. It was no longer about restoring democracy to Mexico. And that was just the beginning of the betrayal.
So what is it that really sets the stage for the Texas Revolt?
Well, we have argued that there's two ways to look at every revolution, the triggering, what actually triggered it, and the underlying causes. And we've argued, as I think many academics have, that the underlying cause here was slavery. You know, if you don't look at the underlying cause, you end up thinking the American Revolution was about tea. The triggering mechanism essentially came when the Mexican government, who were giving the, let's be clear, Santa Anna is often portrayed as this dastardly dictator, and granted, the man was no saint, but he had given these American colonists everything they wanted, including a 2-year tax amnesty. And it was when the Mexican government said, you know, guys, it's time to actually start collecting taxes again in 1835, that some of the Americans got a little upset. One of them, a hothead in the Houston area named William Barrett Travis, decided to launch his own raid and kill a few Mexican soldiers, which he did, at which point, as most sovereign governments would do, the Mexican government in Mexico City said, we're going to send a little force in, and we're going to arrest these hotheads and put them on trial, at which point Texas revolted.
Do you want to add to that, Chris?
Well, I mean, it's... these were most of these people who were trying to overthrow the government, who were trying to win independence for Texas, were illegal immigrants. They weren't even authorized to be in Texas. They had snuck across the border without permission from the Mexican government. They had not become Catholics. They had not pledged allegiance to the Mexican Constitution and the Mexican government and the Mexican state. And that was what was required back then. And that's the great irony here. is that it was Texas was stolen by illegal immigrants who happened to be Anglo from Mexico.
More of my conversation with Brian Burrow and Chris Tomlinson when we come back.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Here's the rest of my conversation with Brian Burrow and Chris Tomlinson, co-authors of the new book titled Forget the Alamo. So tell us now about these monumental characters, Jim Bowie and Davy Crockett. What roles do they play, Brian?
Well, we can't just take those two, Diane. We have to refer to the Holy Trinity, as it's often called, which is Crockett, Bowie, and William Travis. Crockett is the one that probably history has about right. He was a down-on-his-luck former Tennessee congressman, voted out of office, kind of a laughingstock in Washington, who had a very big, he was quite famous in the day, because of his public persona, which was a real cornpone type of hee-haw frontier guy. People ate that up until they didn't anymore. At which point Crockett, like a lot of people, said, okay, you need a new start, where do you go? The obvious place a lot of people were going, especially in the westernmost part of the American South, was they were going to Texas. So Crockett rode in return for some land, had to sign up for a spell in the Texas Army, which put him to, as fate would have it, the Alamo. Crockett was far from a fighting man at that point. He was a paunchy 49-year-old, but a little guard duty was what it took to get into a new political life in Texas. He was fine with it. Jim Bowie is really my favorite because he's really seen by a lot of Anglo-traditionalists as kind of the Steve McQueen of the Alamo, if you will, the romantic hero, the one, you know, the fighting man, taken down by booze and sickness and who fought till the end. In fact, we now know from academic research over the last 50 years that Bowie came to Texas not because he was some romantic figure in pursuit of adventure. He was fleeing federal investigations into a series of amazingly brazen land swindles he had attempted in Louisiana and Arkansas. If Jim Bowie had stayed in America, there's every reason to believe he would have ended up swinging at the end of a rope. He came to San Antonio, he married quite well, and his very wealthy father put him up in a series of business adventures, each of which failed spectacularly, leading to, by 1835, at the time of revolution, he was kind of a figure of fun in San Antonio. The Tejanos called him Jim Bowie the Braggart. He drank a lot. William Barrett Travis, the third member of the Trinity, was similarly came to Texas, like a lot of Texans, because things had not gone his way in Alabama. He fled Alabama, leaving behind a raft of debts, a wife and children, and came to Texas and immediately successfully set up a little law practice and fell in with a bunch of Southern-bred malcontents, many of them lawyers and land speculators, who wanted rid of the Mexican government. And it was Travis, really, whose raid on Anahuac in 1835 really got this all this going. And as luck would have it, he ends up with Bowie as the co-commander of the Alamo in early 1836. And that's kind of the groundwork that fate led them to.
So, Chris, what actually happened at the Alamo?
Well, there was a lot of hubris and a lot of miscalculation. They had managed to capture the Alamo from the Mexican army in October.
How many Anglos are we talking about?
You know, that's one of the most hotly debated topics out there. You know, we probably maybe 180 Anglos, maybe 30 to 50 Tejanos. There were a lot of women, children, teenage boys who were helpers. There were at least three slaves. Travis had brought his slave, Joe. And there's still enormous debate who fought, who was just there, who was Anglo, who was Tejano. But generally, it's accepted there were 189 so-called defenders, heroic defenders.
And what was their goal?
You know, that's what we still don't completely understand. Sam Houston had sent Jim Bowie down to blow up the Alamo, gather up all the troops, and bring them up to Gonzales or Washington on the Brazos because he had no army. And he couldn't afford to let 200 guys, you know, sit on a crossroads in San Antonio. He had no way to reinforce them. And he actually needed to form an army and get everything organized. Jim Bowie was from San Antonio. You know, he'd lived there. He had romantic ideas about it. And so he decided to stay. Travis went down. You know, the understanding was that Travis was supposed to assess the situation. He got convinced to stay. Davy Crockett just wandered in. And they didn't expect Santa Anna to come for another 2 months. They thought, we need the rains to come. The rains will turn the grass green. Then the cavalry will have plenty of fodder for their animals. And only then will Santa Anna come up. Well, Santa Anna surprised everyone, arrives, and does not even, you know, doesn't really give them a chance to run away. And they probably should have, and they probably would have if they could have. But they were caught by surprise and trapped inside.
And the numbers, Diane, you have to keep in mind, were just overwhelming. I mean, for all the overall strategic surprise of Santa Anna's advancement, within the 2 weeks leading up to Santa Anna's arrival, the Texans absolutely knew what was coming. And Santa Anna was bringing 6,000 soldiers with 200 Texans. Why on earth did Travis and Bowie decide to stay? The logical answer is they believed reinforcements, which they were believing, you know, writing letters every day to Houston and to the Texas government, they believed would come. I think there's also probably, and this is entirely speculative, that William Barrett Travis had never commanded anything in the world, and he had quite an ego. And one gets the sense he wasn't eager to give up his first posting. I've always kind of believed that. We don't even advance that in the book, I should say. It's entirely speculative. But the fact is, they shouldn't have stayed. You know, there was the Alamo had some strategic value, but there was no talk about let's delay these guys so Houston can hold an army. That all came up much later as a justification or for rationalization. But once Santa Anna showed up, they were trapped. They could not get away. And for all the legend of the Alamo's bravery, it's hard to say that, you know, it wasn't like they had a choice to stay and fight. They got trapped there and they fought until they were killed.
What did the Alamo look like back then in 1836?
Well, it was a huge compound. You know, today we think of the Alamo as the church with the hump facade. That facade was not there back then. That was added in the 1840s. It had a horizontal roof line. The Spanish priests had abandoned it because they'd miscalculated and the roof had collapsed on the church. So the church was basically just a place where you kept goats and sheep and maybe your horses at night. The main building was the old convent, the old housing that the priests and the missionaries had lived in. It was a two-story structure, thick stone walls, and that is actually where everyone stayed. That was the center of the fortress. Then around it, you have this very low, you know, maybe 12-foot wall where Native American converts to Christianity had set up little grottos to live in as they worked the fields for the priests and went to mass every day. And so you had this huge compound of hardpan dirt in the middle with 1,500 graves, because that's where the Native American converts were buried after they died. And 200 men to basically, you know, almost a, what was it, Brian, a 2 mile perimeter?
No, it was like the Alamo was like a mile around. And even Travis, an amateur commander who did realize that it was almost impossible to defend. There were no, you know, gun sights. Men up on the walls were clearly silhouetted. There was nothing really to hide behind. about the best thing that the Texians had going for them is they had captured in a ruthless battle in December, in the Battle of San Antonio, they had captured the city and the Alamo, and in so doing, picked up, I want to say, 21, 24 pieces of Mexican artillery. So they had lots of artillery, but they barely had enough men to make them work, and they seriously did not have enough men to adequately defend a compound that was never set up to be a fortress in the first place.
I want to go back for a minute about these converts to Christianity among the natives there. Was there an active recruitment on the part of the Americans who were in Texas to recruit them to Christianity?
No, that was all done by the Spanish missionaries. So the Alamo was established in 1719. The structure was built 100 years before the battle, and the Spanish missionaries had abandoned it for the four other missions around San Antonio 30 years earlier. But no, there was no missionary purpose from the American perspective. By the time the Americans began settling, the Catholic churches were well established, and the missionary work had moved on to farther outside the city.
So it sounds as though when Santa Anna sent in his troops, it was slaughter at the gates.
It was. And yet you would think, with the Mexicans having 6,000 soldiers and poor Travis having maybe 180 on a good day, that they would have just run over them. In fact, as adept a commander as Santa Anna could be in many battles, he had a bad day that day. The key to getting over the walls they had planned was a bunch of handmade ladders. And so a lot of infantrymen come running toward the walls in the pre-dawn hours with these ladders. And we now know that most, if not all, of these 30-plus ladders collapsed, and they didn't get the men up the walls. And so at the north wall, where the great mass of Mexican soldiers was scheduled to storm the compound, suddenly you get this great mass of humanity. It's like a Who concert, Diane, with, you know, 1,000 Mexican soldiers rammed up against this wall, and the only thing there is a bunch of Americans on the top shooting down into them. So there is this desperate moment where the Mexican soldiers physically climb this 12-foot wall, and there's just so many of them. Many were killed, but eventually they got over. And once the first Mexicans get over, and granted, you know, the accounts of this are kind of flashes in the dark night of fact. You know, we know a lot about what happened, but we don't know everything that happened. But it's very clear that once the first Mexican soldiers get over, it's not quite a massacre, because the Americans are able, many of them, to retreat to this concrete building, the Long Barrack, which the Mexicans then stormed. The Mexicans turned the Americans' own artillery on that building and began blasting away. It was a furious hand-to-hand fighting in the dark of night, and ultimately a slaughter.
So what were the early accounts of that battle? What were people reporting about that battle?
Well, you know, there are two channels here, of course. There's the Mexican channel and the Anglo channel. And they tell very different stories. Santa Anna just thought of it as a minor skirmish. His officers were kind of disgusted because it had gone so poorly. They were also disgusted because they'd captured Davy Crockett and a number of other Anglos and executed them in front of the chapel. And, you know, under international law, these people were considered pirates. They were not considered a foreign military force. So, you know, you can execute pirates and criminals. And that was Santa Anna's perspective on the Texians. Santa Anna then released an Anglo woman named Suzanne Dickinson and Joe, Travis's slave, to go tell the Americans what happened, to describe the massacre and to describe his army and make it very clear that if they wanted to live, they needed to head for Louisiana as fast as they could. And that was the message that a lot of the Anglos got. That's what we call the runaway scrape. Once word reached Houston and Washington on the Brazos that the Mexican army had committed this massacre, this bloody victory in San Antonio, everyone was on the run. Sam Houston, who was in charge of forming a Texian army, he seized on an idea. He said, you know, within 72 hours, the newspaper was printing that the defenders of the Alamo died like Spartans at the Battle of Thermopylae. They sacrificed their lives to slow the army. You know, this was the 19th century. The Spartans were considered the height of manhood and courage and bravery. And this message just really resonated. And that was the beginning of the myth. But Sam Houston, he was just looking for a way to stop the runaway scrape, keep his men from deserting, and explain why he had failed to send reinforcements to San Antonio despite a week of letters from Travis begging for them.
And we should say, Diane, that Houston's idea of turning the Alamo into a moral victory, if you will, was spectacularly successful in that this idea infused his hastily built little army, which was going to have to face off with Santa Anna, and really did do wonders for their morale. When Houston's little army attacked Santa Anna at San Jacinto 6 weeks after the Battle of the Alamo, they charged yelling, "Remember the Alamo." And it gave them a purpose. It gave them a cause. It gave them a feeling that as much as force of arms carried them to victory.
And we also need to remember that in the United States, in New Orleans, in Cincinnati, in every port that dealt with cotton, this message flew like wildfire. I mean, within another 72 hours, every newspaper in the United States was reporting the massacre and the death of Davy Crockett by what at the time they called Mongol hordes. There was a thick racist element to the messaging on this. And you've got these newspapers in the South calling for every able-bodied young man to go prove their courage in Texas, to go fight for their fellow white man in Texas. And it worked. This whole idea of the Spartan Thermopylae, you know, sacrifice at the Alamo led to thousands of young men started flowing towards Texas. They were still arriving weeks after the Mexican army was defeated at San Jacinto. It was so effective. So it was truly one of the great pieces of psychological warfare in history.
And what happened when they all arrived?
Well, by the time most of them had arrived, including an entire expedition from Natchez in Mississippi, the fighting was over. Most of them ended up either getting a job or most of them just went home. And at that point, Texas became an independent country. And for 9.5, 10 years, it remained so, at the end of which it joined the United States, by which point what we call the heroic Anglo narrative of the Texas Revolt of the Alamo was being built. There were not professional historians, by and large, at that point. The myth was promulgated initially by amateur historians, very few of which wrote about the Alamo itself because they knew so little about it. There were no American survivors. Mexican accounts would not be seen for years. And so you get, Diane, beginning in the 1830s and continuing into Civil War times, you get just this free flow of literature, much of it pulp novels, pulp fiction, that uniformly trumpets the Anglo victory over the mongrel Mexican hordes. It's amazing, and yet it created a myth in Texas that to a large degree persists to this day.
So thus far, you both talked about men and their involvement. What about Clara Driscoll? What about Adina de Zavala? Who are they and what roles did they play, Chris?
After the Civil War, you know, you had a lot of widows, a lot of orphans, a lot of women who were left behind because of their relatives dying at the battle. And so remembrance became a big thing. And forming these heritage societies and these remembrance societies became truly important. And you began to see them also form in Texas. Adina de Zavala was the granddaughter of a Mexican politician, perhaps one of the most famous politicians of his day, who, after Santa Anna suspended the Constitution, had come to Texas to seek allies to help fight Santa Anna and restore democracy to Mexico. Well, Lorenzo de Zavala quickly figured out that The Anglos had something else in mind, and he agreed to kind of be a figurehead to present a multi-ethnic look to the Texas Revolution. He would later quit because he was so disgusted and sidelined, and he realized he was being used. But, you know, he's still a very important figure as the first vice president of the Republic of Texas. And Dina de Zavala, also her relatives had also fought at the Battle of San Jacinto. So she took it upon herself to start remembering the revolution. In 1886, 15 years after the battle, the Alamo was falling apart. The battle wasn't being remembered. The editor of the San Antonio Express newspaper complained, "Why can't we remember the Alamo anymore?" And Adina de Zavala took that on herself. And she began to promote these stories and the myths that she had learned. But she didn't have any money. And these missions, including the Alamo and the Long Barrack, desperately needed money to fix them up. And she happened to, purely by chance, run into Clara Driscoll, the wealthiest woman in Texas at the time. She was all of 19 years old. Her mother had just died. She was looking for purpose in this world. She was a powerful personality. Both of them were well known as being, you know, these strong women who worked hard, but they weren't allowed to vote. They weren't allowed to hold office. And so the only way they could really participate in society and influence politics was through these societies. And they became the leaders in the Daughters of the Republic of Texas. They pressured lawmakers to spend money to buy the Alamo, to fix it up, and most importantly, to put them in charge of it. And so they then turn on one another because Adina wants to preserve the site. She wants to preserve the Long Barrack. Clara's like, "No, the Long Barrack's ugly. I want to have a big park. I want it to be like Paris." Adina wanted a battle site. And eventually the woman with the money wins. Adina is shunted off. Clara tears down most of the Long Barrack and gets the park that she had always wanted. But they really were responsible for perpetuating the myths.
You also have movies that perpetuate the myth. I mean, I think about John Wayne and Davy Crockett and, you know, what we've lived with for all these years.
The Alamo myth that, you know, that Clara Driscoll perpetuated, that really more than anyone, she took over the site. She was Mrs. Alamo for most of the 20th century. Nevertheless, by the 50s, let's say, the Alamo was still pretty much a regional phenomena. There weren't people in Paris and London who just thought this was the coolest thing and let's go visit. It was kind of a Texas thing until the 1950s, when Walt Disney, who was beset by labor unions infested with communists in Hollywood, wanted to go out and start making non-animated live-action TV shows that would promote what we call today family values, patriotic values. And he sent his screenwriters off in search of heroes. They came back with a few good ones. Zorro, I remember, was one. But the big one was Davy Crockett, who was all but forgotten history at that point. And in the hands of Walt Disney and his men, his people, Davy Crockett was put at the center of three massively successful made-for-television movies in the 1950s that, as you may remember, created this huge Davy Crockett craze and really introduced the rest of the world, the rest of the country, to the idea of the Alamo. And this was not an historic Davy Crockett. There was no down-on-his-luck, you know, Tennessee congressman. This was a stern, stoic, good frontiersman who always did the right thing. It was a cartoonish figure in some way. But that almost pales before John Wayne's Alamo, because John Wayne, even more than Walt Disney, wanted the commies and the lefties put in their place. And he believed the way to do it was to produce and make his own Alamo. And he did. The 1960 movie, The Alamo, which was a box office failure, but one could argue very much a cultural success, insofar as many, if not most, of the people who suddenly discovered the Alamo in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, you know, they came in search of John Wayne. They came in search of Disney's Davy Crockett. And the Alamo went from being this kind of quiet Texas shrine to, something that was known nationally and internationally, and that became over that time because of those depictions, kind of a symbol of American freedom, American conservative values, all of which was enshrined by LBJ in the 60s. Because, you know, for LBJ, as we've referenced, the Alamo was kind of a consuming thing. He used to famously recite poems about the Alamo at White House dinners.
So I was in Austin a number of years ago and did go visit the Alamo. What history is the Alamo telling now, and how will that change as the governor's order about teaching his kind of history be put in place, Chris?
This is what we call the next battle of the Alamo. You have a city that is, you know, majority Hispanic, majority Tejano, who's got significant part of their population wants nothing to do with the Alamo. And that story and that myth and that heroic Anglo narrative. And then you have, you know, people like Greg Abbott, the governor, Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, and even George P. Bush, Jeb Bush's son, George W. Bush's nephew, who they understand that their success in Republican politics is to push that heroic Anglo narrative, to stand by the myths, because that's what the Republican Party resolved at their state convention. When we were writing the book, this battle was already taking place. There's a proposal to spend hundreds of millions of dollars to remodel the plaza, try to restore the original footprint of the Alamo as much as possible, to build a $200, $300 million museum and visitor center. And there's a massive argument between, you know, the Hispanic Texans, conservative Texans, liberal Texans, about what is the story we're going to tell? Because people come to the Alamo because of Davy Crockett and the John Wayne movie. They want to see a battle site. But there are 1,500 Native Americans buried under the street in front of the Alamo. There is a former lunch counter where African Americans fought for desegregation and civil rights. And these communities all want to be honored on a place that is 300 years old, and most Anglos only want to remember 13 days. So I don't know what's going to happen. On Friday, there was a protest in front of the Alamo. Members of LULAC, a Hispanic activist group, showed up to demand that the true story be told, and they came carrying our book, copies of Forget the Alamo. And then a militia showed up. This is Texas Freedom Force, in body armor with assault rifles across their chest, promising that they will fight to the death to defend the Alamo. In many ways, this conversation's just beginning.
Wow, what a story. And what about pushback from those who have seen your book, seen your story? What are they saying?
Well, the book's only been out for what, 6 days? We got our first two politicians came out after us yesterday, led by the outgoing chairman, the flamethrowing chairman of the Texas GOP, Alan West, who basically said that every Texan should be offended by what we've written. And, you know, you kind of smile because that's what you expect. We got our first physical threats this weekend, which was a high point. So, you know, it's all just kind of beginning right here. We've really reached over backwards not to come off as preachy know-it-alls, because we're not. We're journalists and writers who find the disconnect between historical fact and historical fiction just absolutely fascinating. The book is not overtly political, no matter how it's been greeted. And so we are kind of now looking around, checking our Twitter feeds in mock horror as people kind of, you know, get their hair on fire over this.
Last word, Chris.
You know, people don't know where these stories came from. They don't understand how they were invented. And to me, that's the most important part, is that you need to understand the fairy tales, who wrote them, how were they made. And then if you want to still believe them and share them as tall tales, Texans have been doing that forever. But don't pass it off as the truth. And most importantly, understand that there's another perspective, because when we demand that the heroic Anglo narrative be the dominant one and the only acceptable one, we are rejecting the personal histories of the Tejanos, of the African-American Texans, of the people who've been on the outside of this story for too long and have suffered as a result. So let's just, you know, open our minds a little bit and let some other people in.
Chris and Brian, thank you for your work.
Thank you,
thank
Diane.
Thank you, Diane.
That was Brian Burrell and Chris Tomlinson, co-authors of the new book titled Forget the Alamo. And that's all for today. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Thanks for listening. Be well. Stay safe. I'm Diane Rehm.